This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Earlier this year, the Corrections Department entered into a contract with the GEO Group for Vermont's out-of-state prisoners. Previously, the state had contracted with the Corrections Corporation of America to house these inmates. The new contract meant a move for our out-of-state inmates to a facility in Michigan. Then Corrections Commissioner Andy Pulido said cost was just one factor in the decision, but not the biggest one.
Predominantly, the current contract with CCA has us in a facility that is largely open style, so people have a lot of freedom of movement, which is a good thing. However, when we have instances of fights, assaults, those sorts of things, there's no way to contain the population. So what we've looked for in this contract was a more secure environment for when we need it. Second, it's an environment that allows all of our population. So we don't have people going to Kentucky, people going to Arizona.
In September, shortly after the prisoner move, Andy Pulido was tapped to be Governor Shumlin's new finance commissioner. And Deputy Commissioner Lisa Menard moved into the top post in corrections. She's been working for the department in one job or another for 29 years. And today we're going to talk with her about her strategy for running the department, as well as issues like the prisoner move, the declining number of inmates in Vermont custody, and the political and cultural conversations about what's appropriate when it comes to incarceration. Commissioner Lisa Menard, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Those prisoners have all moved now from Kentucky to the prison in Michigan. How do you think the move went?
I think the move went very well. It was incredibly well planned out. We had staff, Vermont staff, at both Kentucky and Michigan for quite some time, about a month, to ensure that it went smoothly.
There have been complaints, though. According to an article that Dave Graham wrote for the Associated Press, the complaints have been fairly wide-ranging. I mean, there are a number of complaints that have come in. Some of them include things like no access to premium cable or movie channels, but others say that health complaints aren't being responded to, or that there's a lack of privacy in the showers, which is an issue with the Prison Rape Elimination Act. So how are you responding to complaints that are coming in as this transition period is still ongoing in Michigan?
As the complaints come in, we actually have our staff, when they visit the facility, to check into all the complaints, to check the showers, to check whatever other concerns. We have medical staff in Vermont that also look at any medical issues that arise there. They're fairly promptly looked into, and in fact, we've just started an FAQ section on our website so that people can go in and see the questions that have been asked and what the response was.
And what have the responses been from the department?
On some issues, primarily what I've heard have been around access to a dentist on site has been the main thing I've heard. I've heard issues around not enough jobs. Some of those things, the dentist, that's an issue everywhere, not just, unfortunately, Michigan. There is a dentist that is available now. He is not on site. The availability of dentists is very limited.
You mentioned jobs.
Thank you. As far as jobs, we're currently at one job for every two inmates in Michigan. That's actually better than the ratio in Vermont. We continue to look. I spoke just yesterday with a representative of GEO to look at, are there other opportunities for legitimate jobs, work that actually needs to be done? The previous contract, inmates were paid to attend school. That's not something we do in Vermont. We don't really want to set up a dynamic where it becomes an expectation.
And what about that issue of the showers? My understanding was that there were no shower curtains that closed, and so there was a privacy concern in Michigan that was partly then related to this law, the Eliminate Prison Rape.
Yeah. I don't have the specific answer to that. I suspect it's probably in the FAQs. If it came in as a complaint, it would have been looked into, and particularly if it came in as a complaint related to PREA.
We're talking today with Corrections Commissioner Lisa Menard. We're talking right now about this transition from prisoners who were incarcerated out of state in Kentucky and have now moved to Michigan. Some issues there with the transition, although Commissioner Menard says overall it went very smoothly. And we'd like to know what questions you have for the commissioner. We're going to talk about health oversight in Vermont prisons. We're going to talk about the prison population, why it's dropping. And we're going to talk about Commissioner Menard's overarching view of how the department should be run done and what the right, if this is the correct word, but what the right number of inmates is in the state. Certainly a conversation that's going on beyond the bounds of the Department of Corrections. So if you'd like to share your thoughts on that, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a thought on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. So one of the other complaints, as I understand it, coming out of Michigan is a complaint about the lack of freedom. And we heard Commissioner Polito, former Commissioner Polito, talking about the structure of the prison in Michigan being very different, a little bit less open than the prison in Kentucky was. And there have been some complaints about that. What do you think is the optimal level of freedom? I mean, we're talking about the way a prison is structured. We're talking about movie channels. We're talking about a lot of different things that prisoners have a right to say, you know, why don't I have this or can I have this? So what do you think about that idea of what the level of freedom is within the confines of somebody who's being incarcerated?
Well, I think inmates need the ability to be able to, within the confines of the facility, to be able to move freely to their programming, to classrooms, to medical. And when I say move freely, I don't mean the doors are open, unlocked all the time. I mean, there is an ability. There are movement windows to be able to do that. Some of the differences between a dormitory type of living environment and the difference in Michigan is that somebody has a designated room. You can go, you can look, you can see someone's in your room. This is not your room. Leave this room. In a dormitory style, it's much more difficult to really determine who's supposed to be where. So I think that you need to be able to provide both freedom of movement to get where you need to go, but less so as it involves safety and security.
Which is what Commissioner Polito was saying, that actually you were more pleased, the department was more pleased with this idea of having something that was a little bit more contained and a little bit easier for to know where people should be and get them there.
That's exactly right. The structure provides that, and that's really caused some of the difficulty in adjustment. It's very difficult for the inmates to go from really open setting to a lot more structure.
You mentioned that the jobs issue is one that has, it's a change from Kentucky to Michigan, but you said that actually in Vermont, it's an even greater disparity between the number of inmates and the number of available jobs.
Unfortunately so, yes.
Why is that?
There's not necessarily enough paid work as there are inmates.
Is that up to the Department of Corrections to create those jobs, or are those outside employers saying, I'd like to hire this population?
No, we're talking about within the facilities. So it is up to the Department of Corrections to create those jobs, to really evaluate what do we need an offender to do for us that we could pay. And then even to look beyond that, what could we create as an opportunity, not just for somebody to earn money, but for somebody to be productive throughout the day and learn some skills for when they leave. We have varying levels. We have our Vermont Correctional Industries. We have a wood shop. We have a metal shop. We have a barbering program. We have different OSHA certification programs. We have culinary to some extent. And then there's your everyday cleaning jobs. There's any number of jobs, but there are less than there are inmates.
Is there a priority to get more, or is that just the status quo?
No, I think I would like to see more for many reasons. Giving skills to inmates, filling idle time, making people productive. So I would certainly like to see the creation of more jobs, but I also don't want to see it come to the point where we're paying for things that are really, they're not needed, they're not necessarily providing any value. And we end up having an inmate have a two-hour job, you know, and just so everybody can have something to do.
We got a note from Aaron who says, countless studies show that quality education is an important and highly effective part of reducing recidivism. It's my understanding, Aaron says, that the process of educating inmates involves collaboration among caseworkers, probation officers, and correctional educators to not only identify those with an education need, but also to compel them to come to school and implement consequences when they fail to follow through with their case plans. My question is twofold. One, do you agree that education is an important part of the corrections process? And two, do you believe that your department is doing enough to identify and hold accountable those inmates and supervisees who need educational programming?
I definitely agree with the first part. I do think that education is a very important component. There are studies that show it certainly assists in reducing recidivism. It also, again, it gives somebody something productive to do during the day. I've certainly seen in the graduations I've attended, it gives an inmate an incredible amount of pride to have achieved that, and that's valuable in and of itself. The second part of the question is a little bit more difficult. Do I think we're doing enough? I think we're doing more than we have in the past. As Aaron mentioned, it really has become a coordinated effort between casework, the high school staff, even security staff to look at what are the full, looking a little more holistically, what are the needs of this offender? If education is one, how do we build that into their case plan, into their schedule? The hard part of that question for me is the consequences part, because really, what do you do if somebody in a facility declines to go to an education class? The alternatives are, do you keep them in longer on their sentence? That doesn't necessarily seem an appropriate consequence. I think I would rather look at incentivizing education. If we look at an incentive plan, not just for education, but for case plan compliance, how can we make that so that somebody wants to do those things until they want to do them just on their own?
But the incentivization, you mentioned that in Kentucky, inmates were paid mm-hmm. to go to school, and that's not something that you'd like to see.
I wouldn't like to see them paid to go to school. I would like to see us develop an incentive plan for full case plan compliance, where if you have an agreement that I'm going to do these 10 things this week, that if you do those 10 things, there is some form of incentive. Likely not money, but other things.
Like what?
It's possible something that they can't get off commissary, or they could get it, but not in this size or not this particular, you know, brand kind of a thing. Something like that.
Not necessarily a reduction in time.
That's not an option. I mean, there is no longer any earned reduction of term. There's statutory reduction. There's not earned reduction unless you're at a work camp.
We're talking to Lisa Menard. She's the Corrections Commissioner, and if you have a question for her, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Commissioner, we got three questions about health and particularly mental health, so I'm going to read them together, and then we can address that question. John says, what is the prison system doing to meet the needs of mentally ill inmates? Do you think it's doing enough to meet those needs? Representative Cynthia Browning says, we should have built a forensic patient/offender wing and a secure residential wing in the new psychiatric hospital in Berlin. We did not build enough beds, and many people argued for more, but the administration brushed them aside. It would have been better to have done something a little scaled down at the Waterbury State Office building and spent more money on this problem. If people don't have proper treatment while incarcerated, they're likely to cause difficulties for public safety on release and end up back inside. And we got a note from ex-VSH guy, ex-Vermont State Hospital guy, who says, does Commissioner Menard think we should set up special units in prison where the mentally ill can be treated? In California, they decided last year to shift mentally ill inmates into separate specialized housing that will offer them more treatment instead of placing them in the same isolation units as other inmates. That happened after a federal judge ruled that California's treatment of mentally ill inmates violates constitutional safeguards against cruel and unusual punishment. So a lot of questions there about how do we treat inmates who have mental health care needs? Are we doing enough, and do we have the right types of facilities for them? What's your perspective, Commissioner?
That is a lot there. I would say for offenders who come in having committed a crime, I think that's we need to keep that piece in mind, that people come to us because they've committed a crime. Those that come in that have, in addition, a mental illness do receive treatment in a facility. There is mental health treatment that is provided both group, individual, pharmacological, if that's necessary as well. That being said, I'm not going to say there are not difficulties in having people who are suffering from mental illness in a facility. It's very difficult. It's difficult for them. It's difficult for staff. It's difficult for the other inmates. Right now, again, these people have committed a crime and come to the Department of Corrections. There's been a lot of conversations lately, most recently Friday at the Joint Corrections, Joint Justice Oversight Committee meeting, talking about really what are some of the possibilities going forward. Some of it goes to Representative Browning's point as well. Secretary Cohen talked about really the brainstorming the agency's doing. Do we need to create some type of forensics capacity in an existing facility? Do we need to look outside? Do we need to look what is available? The bottom line is we have to look at what's safe, what's humane, and what's cost effective. Those are the conversations that are happening now.
Do you have a position that you're willing to take on that? Because there are people who say we need a specialized treatment facility because, I mean, it's become clear, and mm-hmm. the statistics show that you are dealing with more inmates who have more and more serious mental health needs. And then, of course, physical health needs as well, which are also a strain on the system. And in some cases, there are more medical needs that are related to physical health needs as well. But do you think that there needs to be a separate facility for people who are dealing with mental health needs and maybe physical health needs as well?
I think if not a separate facility, there at least needs to be capacity for separation. If it's within a facility, a separate wing, a separate area.
Which you do have in Springfield, right?
We have in Springfield. It's not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily meet the full range of needs of people with mental illness. We may have somebody who upon intake is showing some severe signs of mental illness. Perhaps with us after some time or some stabilization, yes, we have a unit that is more therapeutic. It's geared towards people who are suffering from mental illness, but it doesn't really address the other people, the people who come in destabilized or through time with us may potentially destabilize. I think that's an area that we really need more capacity.
So you would like to see a new building built or a new wing on a building built?
I'd like to see either some building through, let me back up a little bit. The agency just put out a request for information for that exact kind of information.
Agency of Human Services?
Yes, that's right. And that's part of the conversation. Will there be a building? Will we make capacity inside a facility?
Without that, or until that happens, are there changes that you plan to make to the way the department deals with the mental health needs of inmates? There were three inmates who died in Vermont custody in the past year. One was out of state, but still within Vermont's prison system. And in two other cases, there were serious mental health issues that the inmates were affected by. And the Vermont Defender General said that in the case of Annette Douglas, the department didn't pay close enough attention to her mental health issues, although he also noted that she was refusing medical treatment, and that was certainly the biggest issue that led to her death. In the case of Patrick Fennessy, who committed suicide, the Defender General also questioned the mental health treatment that he received. So what changes need to be made?
That's a very tough one to answer. I think we're constantly looking at ways we can improve. It's very unfortunate that something like this happens, and that's the time people want to see what changes you're going to make. This is an ongoing issue where we're constantly looking at what training are we providing our staff? Are we giving them enough? Are the needs being met through the contracted mental health services? But I think it's important to note something that former Commissioner Polito has said on a couple of occasions, that people come into corrections with extremely complex histories, community histories, and there is an expectation that we will be able to turn that around overnight, and that is just not accurate. People who have long, long histories, people who seem to have a true desire to harm themselves, we absolutely do the best we can, but it's difficult to change a lifelong history overnight.
Let's go to Chris, who's on the line with us from St. Albans. Hi, Chris. Go right ahead.
Hello, Jane, Commissioner.
Hi, Chris.
Have a question to, I guess, the overall organization of the Department of Corrections within our state. We're under the agency Human Services. Full disclosure, I'm a former correctional officer. I worked 4 years for the Department of Corrections. So my question being, there are a lot of situations that occur within the facilities that we as correction officers under the Agency of Human Services lack the actual ability to deal with not being sworn officers of the state or law enforcement officers. So when those assaults occur in our relationship with Vermont State Police and introduction of contraband and many other issues that are criminal offenses in the state, could there be a different way, maybe having a few small group of actual certified peace officers adjudicate or investigate or have our own Department of Corrections peace officers within our department so we didn't have to go through VSP and overload their call volume?
Chris, is that what you'd like to see? You'd like to have sworn officers who are part of the Department of Corrections?
I think that it would help a lot on the deterrent side. So as a correction officer, they know that you're bound strictly through the disciplinary process.
Chris, thanks for the call. Appreciate that. Commissioner Menard?
That's a very good question, Chris, and a good point. I want to point out first, we're under the Agency of Human Services versus the Department of Corrections. That's very much different than most other states. The reason we're under the agency is that...
Wait, you said versus the Department of Corrections.
I'm sorry, versus the Department of Public Safety.
Okay, good,
we are
good.
The Department of Corrections.
I was going to say, now you're confusing me. Okay, so you're under the Agency of Human Services
rather than Public Safety, which is different than most other correctional systems. The reason that is, we share the same clients. The end result, the goal is... reintegration, the goal is rehabilitation, but clearly in facilities, the goal is safety and security, just as Chris is talking about. We have partnered very well, I think, with Vermont State Police, and they have responded extremely well to calls around introductions of contraband, to assaults. I don't know that having sworn law enforcement officers in the facility would reduce those things. I think that the response we're getting from the state police has been excellent around investigating and charging, particularly around assaults on correctional officers, which is extremely important that those be charged. I will say one thing we've done probably in the past year or so and are increasing is the use of trained intelligence officers within the Department of Corrections to really try to get ahead of the contraband issues so that we're not dealing with them in the facilities, so that we're keeping that out to the extent possible.
I'm talking with Corrections Commissioner Lisa Menard, and we've got a couple minutes left with you here, Commissioner. So let me ask you about the inmate population.
Sure.
People may have seen a press release that was sent around by Governor Peter Shumlin's staff a couple weeks ago or a week ago now about how the inmate population is at its lowest today than it has been since the early 2000s. And when he sent the press release out, the population was about 1734. And I don't know if you have an update for today.
I think it's 1745 today.
1745 today. Okay, so this is a marked change from just 3 or 4 years ago when it was well over 2,000, around 2,100 every day. That's just the in-state population, and then we add to that the out-of-state?
Both.
Or that's both?
That's both.
So 1734 includes about 250 out-of-state inmates.
241.
You got all the stats.
Yes.
Perfect. What's behind the decline?
There's a couple things behind the decline, and that is really a lot of work by the system, the criminal justice system, the community-based substance abuse system, keeping people out who maybe don't have to come in, keeping people at the lowest level while still providing the appropriate amount of supervision and treatment. It's also about getting people out better prepared to stay in the community, or getting people out as soon as possible if they are lower risk, not to keep people at a higher level than is necessary for a longer period of time.
So you have seen a reduction in recidivism, the number of inmates who have left the prison system and then returned. That's recidivism.
So far, the recidivism rates have stayed flat. We've seen no increase. We've not necessarily seen a decrease, but we only have measured through 2011. It's measured in 3-year increments. So we won't know really the effects long term until, as the years go, 3 years from the time people are released.
Anecdotally, do you have a sense? Because it sounds then from that like the reduction in the prison population is not related at all to the recidivism rate. So it's all about who we are actually putting in prison based on what the crimes they've committed are and whether we're instead doing something like diversion or changing what we decide is a criminal offense or a prison-worthy offense.
I don't know that it's as much changing what we've determined what's a criminal offense. I do think it has more to do with looking at, frankly, what do we want to use a very expensive, very limited resource of a jail or prison bed for? Do we want to use it for people who are perhaps offensive to us in their behavior? Do we want to use it for people who hurt people? And I think that there has been some public policy discussion around what can be safely managed in the community. And we are seeing, because you did ask a question there, anecdotally, I would say we are seeing less returns. We see we have people out on furlough. We're supervising them. We are seeing less returns for serious behavior. Or when we do, it's for a shorter period of time to try to maintain community continuity.
If our prison population right now is significantly lower than it was 4 years ago, why can't we return all of the out-of-state inmates and have them serve out their time in Vermont prisons?
The population is lower than it has been in years, but it's still not low enough to have the open beds. Each time we've had empty beds in Vermont, we do bring people back. That's exactly how we got to 240 out of state. We were at 270 last week. This week we're at 240.
But not enough to bring back those 240?
Not 240 at once, no.
So do you,
if I'm sorry,
yeah,
I apologize.
No, please finish.
There may come a point when we decide you don't want to bring all the inmates back from out of state. All the inmates out of state may not want to be back in Vermont. They may be happier doing their time out of state. And there are some offenders who, based on the offenses they committed, really should not be in a Vermont jail.
Because of our security level?
Because of their security level or for their safety.
Because they would be?
It's potential. There have been certainly some offenses that have been so there have been a lot of media about these offenses that certainly they attract a lot more attention than other offenders.
That's Lisa Menard. She's the commissioner of the Department of Corrections. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Almost a decade ago, Abenaki scholar and paleoethnobotanist Fred Wiseman started working with Abenaki communities as part of the documentation process for federal tribal recognition. While he was in these communities, Wiseman noticed crops that had long been thought to have disappeared growing on the hillsides. It led him to start the Seeds of Renewal Project. He has painstakingly tracked down native seeds and worked to get those seeds preserved and back into agricultural production. But just as crucial as growing the crops is reinvigorating the connection to traditional cultural rituals that are tied to agriculture. Fred Wiseman spoke with VPR's Patty Daniels about how the project has been developing.
What kind of crops are we talking about? Are they mostly grains?
Well, it's a very large variety of different types of crops. Of course, the grains that are represented, the main, of course, is corn. Corn was domesticated in the New World. It's strictly a New World crop. And we now have four, maybe five this year, distinct varieties of corn. But we also have about 8 to maybe 10 varieties of beans. Several squash. We also have sunflowers, which could be classified as a grain, as well as ground cherries, pumpkins, gourds, a lot of other things.
And these are all varieties that were thought to have long since disappeared. So when you first started seeing these plants growing on hillsides, how did you know that what you were seeing were these rare or endangered or thought to be extinct plants?
Well, the first one that I saw was Helianthus tuberosus, or the Jerusalem artichoke. There was a quarter-mile-long clone at the Wrongway Bridge in Cambridge that was growing. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. Somebody must have sown a lot of Jerusalem artichokes through there. Jerusalem artichokes aren't a very popular crop right now. So I figured that these might be an ancient clone. So what I did in 1994, I guess, was put a stake at the leading edge of the clone. And then I was able to record over the last few years that it had actually been spreading about more or less a foot a year, which takes us back to 400 to 600 years ago is when it got started.
Wow.
So that was the first one.
And so when you saw that plant growing, did you start to try to gather those seeds?
Oh, yes. The Jerusalem artichokes are best propagated by tubers. They have tubers. They don't really set seed very well here in Vermont. The season is too short for them. But then I started talking with old-time Abenaki farmers, and it turns out there were a lot of other crops that people had just barely been holding on to here in Vermont and also in New Hampshire. And recently I've discovered quite a few over in Maine.
And so what does it take to actually get those seeds into production, to really – to gather the wild seeds, but also to cultivate them to grow more crops and yield more seeds?
Well, the first step is to actually track down the – some of these seeds are of crops that have been rumored, like Algonquin squash. I learned that that was supposedly an Abenaki variety. Other people have heard of it. People grew it years ago, but nobody could give me a viable modern seed that was raised by indigenous people. So it took me a long time, I call it chasing seeds, to be able to locate sources. And I found one group of native seed savers in Manitoba, up in Canada. They kept it. And so I was able to get that variety from them, bring it back to the United States and start growing it.
And do you feel that's the same kind of seed that would have grown here 400 years ago?
Well, a colleague of mine, Steve McComber, who is probably the foremost Haudenosaunee or Iroquois ethnobotanist, has studied this for years, basically to study what's Iroquois. But he also has to understand what isn't to be able to know what's his. And so he was the person that gave me a lead on that from stories, oral history, and some old other documents.
And is there the possibility of cross-pollination?
Oh, my gosh, yes.
And what kind of concern does that raise for you?
A huge concern. The big problem is that corn will cross-pollinate, and various squashes and pumpkins will also cross-pollinate. And so the Seeds of Renewal Project has been very careful in making sure that the people that are partners that grow it out only raise one specific type. There are two specific kind of species of pumpkins, let's say. Those can be raised next to each other because they don't cross-pollinate. But you can't have two, let's say, there's a species called Cucurbita pepo. You can't have those within a mile of each other. And so what I've done is I've distributed these seeds out to various growers, and they have to make the choices to where they're going to plant them, how they're going to plant them. There's other techniques, like you can plant them at different times so they'll flower at different times. You can actually even close up the pollinated flowers of squash and things. There's a lot of other techniques, but basically you got to keep them separated.
And the reason for keeping them separated is
to prevent cross-pollination. Once you cross-pollinate these, it's very, very difficult to get the original germplasm back. And it's almost as if they've crossed over the threshold into extinction.
You were able to find a community that was really interested in pursuing this work. Is it pronounced Kowasik?
That's correct.
Tell us about the Kowasik community.
I worked for years with the different Abenaki bands on documenting their history. And one of the bands that recently achieved state recognition was the Kowasik Band. They're over in the Connecticut River Valley in the Haverhill, New Hampshire, Newberry, Vermont area. And I asked them about their crops, and they had received back from some old hill farmers in the area the original Kowas corn. And that got them really excited and started thinking about their identity as woven into their crops and their agriculture. And, of course, I was able to go over and give lectures and talk about my work. They got excited. I gave them the seeds, and they started growing them. And so it's been a wonderful success.
And the seeds are spreading to other areas. You've worked with the Passamaquoddy in Maine?
That's correct. Yeah. Yep. I was able to get the seeds over to two Passamaquoddy reservations, and also a colleague of mine, Barry Dana, in Solon, Maine. He's a Penobscot. We got the seeds to him, and he's been distributing them to Maliseets and Penobscot. So we have a lot of good connections, and the seeds are spreading out.
And so you know, we wouldn't want to let listeners think that this is all seeds for the sake of seeds. There are real agricultural traditions and cultural traditions that are tied to these specific crops.
That's correct.
How have you seen those regrow as well?
Well, that's another part of the work that I did with the tribes was recording their ceremonies, their the ways that they think about corn and things like that. And so what I've been doing for the last probably, three and a half to 4 years is working with especially the COAS, but other bands, and also with the Lake Champlain Maritime Museum and creating programming that will teach the old dances such as the green corn dance or the sun dance and the rain dance. So I've been able to find these in archival videos that have been taken. And so what I've been doing is taking the music, redoing the music. The COAS have a group of women singers that sing these songs, and I've been working with them on the choreography. And so I consider that the agriculture isn't just the seeds, it just isn't the agricultural systems. It includes the ceremony. It also includes the cuisine as well. And I just went to a international conference in Tucson, Arizona, just a little over a week and a half ago. That was a meeting of all the thinkers in indigenous food systems. And it was a real eye-opener for me. I'd been kind of lonely here in Vermont. But going out west, I've discovered that this is a process that's taking place from Alaska all the way to Tierra del Fuego. And we here in the far northeast have not been very interested in indigenous food systems, indigenous cuisine. But I was able to get a lot of support and a lot of inspiration from people that have been doing this for 30 years.
Tell us about what kind of inspiration.
The first thing is that we're not alone. Okay. Seeds of Renewal has been basically a more or less one-person operation. And it's been my responsibility to track down the seeds, to actually figure out the genetics of them, their distribution and things like that. And to actually see that other people have been facing exactly the same kind of dilemmas that I have, and they have developed their protocols and their techniques, their scientific techniques. It really showed me where my strengths have been in my work, as well as some weaknesses that I need to rethink. And of course, the cross-pollination is a big one. And I've got some ideas from them about pollination cages and all kinds of interesting strategies. And so that's the first thing. And the second thing is the importance of indigenous food systems. Elsewhere in the New World, these are very, very, very important and receive huge amounts of public and governmental and organizational support. And there are organizations that specifically deal with what I've been dealing with. So when I've been working here basically in isolation, I didn't realize that there were other people that have been doing this, and there are options that we can face in moving forward. But on the other side, I've realized how much there's a paucity of interest in indigenous cuisine, indigenous food systems in this area. And I think it's the fact that until recognition, Vermont and perhaps to a certain extent New Hampshire really never considered Native people as important, except as kind of as a historical anecdote. But to understand these crops, for example, these crops here are very climatically robust. In other words, the crops that we grow here are zone 4, and those will grow fine in Newfoundland to Georgia. And so in a time of climatic uncertainty, the germplasm that's represented by these crops has great potential for climate change, also for water quality issues, because the agricultural systems are very – they sequester phosphorus. They take it out of the lake in the form of fish fertilizer rather than contribute to it. So there's a whole bunch of potentials that we see in indigenous agriculture that – just working by myself, I really had thought of just in passing, but I never realized how important they could be.
So you've come back from this conference with, you know, an infused energy and inspiration.
Oh, yeah, I'm all fired up.
What's your vision for Seeds of Renewal or the understanding and the awareness of indigenous food systems for the Northeast? What do you imagine this kind of impact could have?
Well, there's – basically, the first stage is education. So I want to thank you very much for giving me the time to be on the air. But I'm working, I have been working and will continue to work with the Archaeological Heritage Center in Barrie. I'm going to, last year I gave several talks on this. I'm going to do it again this year. Seeds of Renewal is partnered with the Center for Integrative Herbalism in Montpelier. We're going to be teaching an actual class in indigenous food systems and food as medicine, which is another important theme. I'm working with the with ECHO, with the Maritime Museum. So these partnerships, what we're doing is going to be ramping these up. For example, I have to take off in just a couple minutes for a meeting that I'm going to be talking with people from the Maritime Museum about a Seeds of Renewal exhibit in 2017. And we're going to have to start thinking about funding, design, and all of that. So things are a-popping.
Why is this work important to you?
Well, I was originally trained at the University of Arizona as a paleoethnobotanist. And when I came to Vermont after leaving MIT, I had to leave that type of training behind because the Abenaki communities here needed me as a scholar, as a historian, as an ethnologist to record their information, and as a political activist to seek justice, social justice for the Abenaki people, which from 1993 until we got recognition just in 2012. That's been the main focus of most of my research, most of my publications. But now that that's done and I've recently retired from Johnson State College, I've decided to go back to my roots. And this is what my training is in. This is an old passion of mine, and it's something that it's kind of making me young again.
Fred Wiseman is an Abenaki scholar and a paleoethnobotanist. He runs the Seeds of Renewal Project, and he was speaking with Vermont Edition executive producer Patty Daniels. And now it's time to read your comments to the program. Joining me is Vermont Edition producer Rick Sangari. Hi, Rick.
Hey, Jane. When we discussed Act 46, the state's new education consolidation law, Mark wrote, "The spending issues that result in rising property taxes come from unfunded mandates placed on the Ed Fund, and the fact that schools are no longer just in the business of educating students, but rather serving as stand-in parents and providing all manner of social and medical services."
And Ryan in Lamoille County posted, "Maybe if the parents of the kids in school had more skin in the game, they might feel otherwise with regards to continual rising education costs. Parents of students must pay more into the system."
Last Wednesday, we talked about food insecurity in Vermont, and Cindy related her story. "I am on disability and have very special food needs due to medical issues and allergies. The state does not take into account my high food expense, and the food stamps I receive only cover about 1/4 of my food needs each month. While I am a huge supporter of the food shelf, it is very discouraging and frustrating that there are almost no options at the food shelves for those of us with food allergies."
On Thursday, we discussed a new report that recommends investments and policies to reduce poverty in the state. Bill wrote, "The so-called war on poverty focused too much on addressing the immediate needs of those in poverty, such as food and shelter, while ignoring the long-term solutions to poverty, like a lack of educational opportunities, minimum wages, job discrimination for ex-felons, and prohibitively expensive health care costs. One of the success stories that came out of the war on poverty is Head Start."
When we talked with Adam Bunting, the principal of Champlain Valley Union High School, about sexting in schools, Elizabeth wrote on Facebook, "Every teen needs to really learn that no matter how much they trust friends, when they put something on the internet, they send a postcard to the world. This has been true for decades, and the only thing that's changed is that the consequences of sending that postcard have become more dire."
Yesterday, we talked with food writers about Thanksgiving traditions. One listener told us about an interesting side dish her family serves called pink stuff. That prompted Wheatley to write, "I had never heard of Cool Whip cottage cheese salads. Google now tells me there are many kinds and many colors. Perhaps I will indeed bravely go there at some point and will then report. Thanks for the recipe and definitely for your program."
And here's that recipe for pink stuff. Take a tub of Cool Whip, mix in roughly 3/4 of a packet of strawberry Jell-O powder, Add in about 16 ounces of cottage cheese, about 2 parts Cool Whip to 1 part cottage cheese. You can adjust the quantities of Cool Whip and cottage cheese for taste and texture, and then fold in a big handful of fruit like apples, bananas, or strawberries, and serve it cold.
It's my lime jello marshmallow cottage cheese surprise with slices of pimento. You won't believe your eyes. All topped with a pineapple ring and a dash of mayonnaise. My vanilla wafers round the edge will win your highest praise.
Rick, what is that music?
Well, it's something that producer Patty Daniels found, and it's, I guess, it was a big hit in the 50s.
Yeah, when Jell-O molds were popular.
That's right.
Well, we love hearing your feedback and your input on the topics we cover. Continue to post on our Vermont Edition Facebook page. You can also post a photo of your Jell-O mold or email vermontedition@vpr.net. Thanks very much, Rick.
You're welcome, Jane.
In the days since the Paris terror attacks, the issues of security and humanitarianism have been at odds in a debate over whether or not the United States should accept refugees from the Syrian civil war. Tomorrow on the program, we'll hear what Vermonters think about these questions and the potential for Syrian refugees to be resettled here in the coming years. Send your questions or comments to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen. We had production assistance from Sarah Matthews. Liam Connors directed the show, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.